Hi, I guess we can start. So my name is Andrei Shalaginov, and I'm research fellow here. So Carl is not here today, because your usual teacher will be Carl Lechter. And today we'll talk about the computer forensics. So I guess you already had a lecture on computer forensics, isn't it? Or, okay. So just a brief note that it will be a capture of the flag today at 6 p.m. It's actually 6:15 in A255. So if any of you interested, you can come and join. It will be given by Ernst & Young. So just remember the room and the time. And you also need to bring your laptop and virtual books. So a short notice also from Carl that you will be giving some presentations basically on 2nd of October in the beginning, so there will be a lecture, but before you will need to present your papers. So, and also there will be a lab lecture given by Jeff Hamm. So yeah, it will be just like training about the digital forensics and how to perform the forensics like on the computers. So I guess some of you already started reading the book about the forensics. So it's chapter 5. And basically you need to go through materials in order to be able to make these lab exercises with Jeff Hamm. So I think it will be based on Linux and Windows, so you just need to keep track of things. So basically, the computer forensics is not just about the computer, but it's also about different devices, like for example tablets, mobile phones. It can be GPS trackers and so on. So there are a lot of things that you can basically apply the forensics. Do you know the digital forensics process? What's this? So basically, how the evidences from the electronic devices are collected. So first you need to identify what are the evidences that you need to discover, what are the devices that you need to process. Then you need to examine them to understand basically what is relevant for your purpose or not. Then you need to collect them and analyze. So what's this? What are the files, for example? What are the information there? And so on. And then here we'll talk basically about the computer forensics. So not the mobile phones, not the IoT, just like normal computers. So like laptops, servers, for example, and so on. Because like each field of forensics, it has own software that needs to be used for this purpose and own file formats, for example, and own approaches. So it, for example, if you have the Android device, it will be quite different from laptop. So you will need to use different tools. You will need to look for different information on those devices. So also here we'll cover mostly the file systems. So what are the properties of file systems, how the files are stored, and what are the things that you can find, what are the metadata that you can find in the basically disks. So like, how many of you use Linux, for example? So it's quite a lot. That's good. Because we will talk about the Windows and we will talk about the Linux today and what are the things that you can extract. So one of the main problems with forensics when you try to understand what happened in the computer and what are the modification, whether it was malware, whether it was a user intentionally did this, you need to understand what are the timelines. So basically, need the timestamps. Need to extract timestamps from file modification, from some log files, for example, and so on, to understand what's happening. So you'll basically have this covered during the exercises with Jeff Hamm. How many of you heard about the timestamp tool or timestamping? Right. So the point that you have the like normal timestamps in the system, which is modification, access, and creation, so MAC, so-called. When those files timestamps are created, basically in the system, and if nothing was tampered with, then you can understand what happens. For example, this file was created first, then it was modified, and then it was accessed again. But then the problem that there can be also the tools that used to modify these timestamps. So it's quite easy to modify them into the system, and anybody who has access to file system can just like change, for example, that the modification date was like this, and then the access date was like this. So it's quite easy to modify, and then it will be difficult to understand what was the timeline. So what was the exact actions that were performed on the computer? So that's why it's quite important to look for several sources of timestamps on the computer. So not just take it as like complete truth, but you need to understand that, for example, you have perfect timeline, but then some dates are not there. So it's probably there too early or too late in the time. So it's, for example, if you look on malware, for example, Windows malware, you can find that there is a compilation date in the file. And basically what happened that some of the attackers, they use these compilation dates, for example, from 1960s or 1970s or like this. And obviously you cannot find like Windows that was produced in 70s. So it's quite obvious that those were like just like modified to some extent. And for example, if you look onto the benign files from Windows, from Windows XP or Windows 10, for example, you can see a distribution of those times. So the compilation times, for example, starting from 90s when the Windows was released and ending like 2017, for example, when you had some updates. So this is a normal timestamp. So the next process would be the collection. So you need to understand what you have. For example, if you have some laptop with Windows or some like commercial server with own operating system with terabytes of data. And then you need to understand how to process. For example, if it is normal desktop with 500 gigabytes hard drive, it's quite easy. You just like copy everything from this laptop. You have physical access. It's no problem. But if it is a server, then it will be quite complicated because you need to get access. You need to understand what the system is running there. It might be some, for example, compiled kernel, which is not quite widely used, and so on. So it can be quite hard to understand how to deal with these servers, and especially for example, when you have a room with servers, it takes a lot of time to extract all the data from these servers. It takes a lot of efforts to find this needle, basically. What's there? Why it is important to forensics investigation? And also, it's quite important to know that nobody performs the full forensics. So it's usually you have like terabytes of data, and if you have one expert looking for every file, and you have like thousands of millions of files on the computer, it's no way that it can be done like in years. So it will take much more time. So usually, what is done is keyword search. For example, you have keywords, you have particular like folders or file names of interest, and then you look into this files to understand what happened. So then in order to get the copy of the disk, you need to use so-called write blocker. So it means that you have a copy of the disk which is identical to the content of the disk, so nothing had changed. To do this, there are a lot of devices. So those devices are quite popular, have different interfaces, you have different standards, how they perform, different speed. and so on, because it might take some hours to get the copy of one disk. And also it's quite important from the perspective of the digital forensics process that when the investigation is started, it's not just that you should shut down the computer, but you also have to look into the memory. So first thing is to look what is the computer like, what is running. For example, if you have Windows and it's logged on, so you have everything in the memory, you have all the processes, you have all the logins into the browser, for example, it makes sense to look first on the what is there, so what is running, because it's volatile. It will disappear after you shut down because of encryption, because of some single sign-on, for example, sessions and so on. So it will be quite hard to get everything. So before you shut down the computer, you need to extract everything that is possible from the running machine. And then, of course, the machine is shut down, and then the information is retrieved from the hard drives. And then, for example, if you have a complete copy of the hard drive, you can, for example, try to boot this machine or what was running on this machine on some other machine, for example, in the lab. And then it makes sense also to perform several copies of the hard drive. For example, when you need to examine several of those in parallel, it makes sense, of course, to perform copies. So this is how it looks like. You have a lot of different interfaces like SCSI, SATA, IDE, for example, and so on. So you have usually the hard drive that is retrieved from the crime scene, and then you have the hard drive which will be a destination, so where you copy that hard drive, the initial one. And then it will take some hours until it complete, especially with like terabytes of data. So here you can see like it's just a pack of different devices. So you can find those that you need, for example, depending on the interface of your source hard drive and depending on the interface of your the destination hard drive. So it's quite convenient to use those, but they're quite expensive. So for example, we have usually seminars at Kripos in May for the master students to try to present their works, and we also have access to their lab. Basically, they can show us what's there, and you can see some of those devices, not only for computers but also for mobile devices. So there are a lot of different interfaces from the history. You can start, for example, from SCSI IDE, which is also ATA, then the SATA goes, and then also for SSD, there are a lot of different interfaces depending on the hard drive and depending on the computer. So how many of you have like SSD? It's quite impressive, so the majority basically. So they're quite different from like spinner hard drive, and the way how they work and the way how they store information quite different. So obviously the set of information or the set of metadata that you think you can extract from those will be different too. And of course there will be different approaches for like mobile devices, for tablets, for cameras, and for other things like IoT, for example. Because they use different hardware, they use different approaches how to store data, how to process data, and of course, like in this lecture, it will be just about the personal computers. And of course, Carl mentioned the Kripos lab because we have access to this lab, and it's really nice to see how they deal with different hardware. For example, if it is mobile devices or mobile phones, as you know, there will be. There were a lot of different mobile phones through the history, and most of them they use some kind of interface which was like unique for this company. Like for example, Motorola, Nokia. I mean, before it was like micro USB, so they had own standard for the data cable, for the power cable, and so on. And you can see basically in Kripos like tens or almost hundreds of connectors for different devices. So it's pretty impressive. So it's quite important also to look into the live system. So not just dump the disk, but also to see what's there. For example, if there was an attack and something happened, so somebody was attacked from this computer, and the computer is running and you can access everything, so it makes just perfect sense to look what's there. There was a case like behind the Silk Road. So how many of you know like what happened there? How basically they caught this guy in the end? So there was investigation for a couple, I think, months or years. It was done by, I think it was FBI who was working on this case. And basically they tried to infiltrate in the forums of Silk Road. So they seized one account, they seized another account, and they seized third account, like of the admin users. And they tried to get like to the head admin at some point, like to see how, I mean, where is he and what he doing? So at some point they figure out the IP and they figure out the location. So, and at that time, just before the closure of Silk Road, he had like just, I think, thousands of bitcoins, and there were a lot of shipments, like also tens of thousands of shipments across the world with like guns, with drugs and so on. So basically what they did, they had an account of admin and they tried to talk to this guy, to head admin. So they established some kind of trust between these two accounts. And at some point, the one that was behind the police, they just like sent a message to head admin asking, can you please check something on the website? So there was encrypted chat room and there was basically a website behind the Tor network. And at some point, they knew where is the guy and they basically knew what he's doing. And he was at that time in the library and he was working like on his computer on Silk Road. And there were a couple FBI agents just behind his back. So they were like looking what he's doing. And they were at the same time writing messages. He just got distracted. So they made some like kind of like scene, you know, they were fighting or something. He got distracted. They pulled the computer and the computer was locked in. So everything was just there. And then they were able to prove that the messages and the information that was sent from the second account appeared on the screen of the of the laptop from this admin. So basically this is how it was done. Because if he had chance just to log off, then no way it can be proved. So it's quite important to look on the computer before you shut down. There was also Google Rapid Response, which is quite nice framework for live for remote forensics. You can do like a lot of different things on different computers, like remotely. And there is also interface for this, so just like cross-check, checking the internet, this tool. And also it's quite important to look in the RAM, because some of the malware, they reside in the memory. So then they do not leave any forensics traces on the disk or in network, for example. So they reside in the memory. And at some point, it's quite important to check. So if you can, for example, make a snapshot of the memory, it's perfect, then you can prove, for example, that if there are some malicious activities on the computer, then there was malware that did this activity and not the user, for example, vice versa. And a lot of tools that you can use for analysis of disks. For example, the free one for Linux that you can try is called SluiceKit, which goes in bundle with Autopsy. So it's quite nice. You just put the image from the disk there and you can analyze, you can look for files, you can search, for example, and so on. So it has really nice interface. There are lots of also commercial tools that you can download, or you can try them like for some trial period for free, for example. And the nice thing about these tools that they can like show you, for example, different metadata that can be found in the system. So like registry, the different attributes from files, and so on. So how many, for example, of you tried FTK Imager? And SluiceKit, for example? I think you will be using it with Jeff, so just like try to have a look what's this and how it works and just to install, because I think it's even in the Linux package like inside, so just you can install it from command line, so no problem. And for example, if you have one person, it's no problem. You can analyze, you can basically process this data in reasonable amount of time. But when you have some commercial distributed system with like hundreds of servers or some big companies, for example, it becomes quite hard to process all of this data. For example, there was a case with 160 Windows systems that were targeted by some attackers for several years. And of course, it's quite hard to understand what happened. So you cannot just go into every of those systems. It's no way that you can do it. So you have to use some advanced techniques. You have to use some automated analysis, intelligent analysis, to be able to locate those of like this large amount of system which are of interest. And there was, of course, some pre-processing done, and only like 80 systems were used for final forensics investigations. So then you have like just incredibly small amount of data that you need to analyze. And the same, for example, do you know the Enron case, Enron dataset? So there was a scandal some 10 years ago or more about the Enron, which was some energy company in the US, and they were like making some tricks with prices. And they released a large database with their emails. You can basically check what are those emails, what they were writing, what are the connection. And just if you want to play, it's really nice how you can, for example, establish the connection between different people in this company. So like some conspiracy theory, for example, and so on. And I think they had at least 100,000 of emails there. So it's quite hard, but it's possible if you use some software, if you use some automated intelligence solution for this, it's no problem. So it's quite important also to keep in mind that the examination is not analysis. So you need to examine to understand what are the traces. So you cannot just go, for example, into 100 emails and check every word or check every sentence, for example. You need to understand what was behind it. So, for example, there was a scandal. You know that there were like key person in this scandal, and you start with analyzing these like emails from these persons. So it's, of course, it's much smaller amount of data that you need to process. So it's quite important also to examine what you have and what's the goal, what you need to find. So, and also about the hard drives, there are a lot of different structures and a lot of different way how you can extract data from the hard drives, not just physically but also logically. For example, physically you basically have the bits on the magnet platters, for example, for old hard drives. But when it comes to logical structure or logical how it's done, how the hard drive is built, and for example, if it was like Linux or Windows, then you have completely different file systems. You'll have completely different partitions and so on. So it's quite important to keep track of those, and also you have different boot records or what that were evolving over time, and so on. So also it can be a RAID, where the drives can be mirrored, for example. So you'll have basically two identical drives with two identical set of information or data. And also file systems. So you have a bunch of operating systems now. Every of those have different file systems that also had evolved over time. So like, for example, Apple, it was HFS, now it's Apple file system, and so on. So it's a lot of knowledge that you need to keep in mind when you process the data. So basically, there are specification of the file systems that you need to refer to when you analyze. For example, if it is Linux, it's one structure. You have inodes, you have logs. If it is Windows, then you have clusters, and so on. So basically, you need to keep in mind how, for example, this compatible with your software that you're using to process this data, to process the information on the hard drives. And also, you need to keep in mind the aspects of the computers. like, for example, if the computer is 20 years old, there will be different interfaces, there will be different amount of memory, and there will be different file system. For example, if the computer is from 90s, you probably will have Windows 3.1 or something, or Windows 95, for example, with much lower amount of memory, with much smaller disks, and so on. So there was, for example, the historical example is the limitation of 640 kilobytes of memory. So this is basically the 16 registers by 64 kilobytes that the processor can access at that time. And if you need more, for example, if you need to access over like 1 megabyte, you need to use some tricks. So you need to modify the system configuration file to access this data. And also different physical characteristics of the hard drives. So you had the tape, you had the normal spinning disks that's still in use today. You have the DVD, CD, which are not quite oftenly used like in the computers now. They still exist, people still use them, but I mean, it got replaced with SD cards, with USB sticks, with cloud-based solution, streaming, and so on. Then you have SSD, which became very popular in like last 2-3 years. And then you have like USB sticks and SD cards, which also grow in capacity, like tens, hundreds of gigabytes. So it's quite important to keep track of such things, how the data is stored, what are the hardware, and how you can access this hardware. So just some example of the hard drives. These probably around like some tens of or hundreds of megabytes, and these are smaller. So recently the hard drives, they became smaller, which with a lot of data. So you can store like gigabytes, terabytes of data. So before you had like kilograms of iron with megabytes of data. And also the interfaces that the hard drives used to connect to the computer, to the motherboard, there were like SCSI. So it was quite popular like starting from 2000 and earlier. So there were lots of devices that you can connect to this interface, and you can do it in parallel. So there were like 7-15 devices per interface. It was quite popular, but then the serial attached SCSI came. So more devices, like 128 devices in serial, full duplex, and hot plugging. So things got involved. And then the integrated drive electronics. So they were also quite popular some 10-20 years ago, still in use. So you had the long cable. Well, I guess many of you remember these long cables, like about 45 centimeters gray, and they usually had like three ports on them to connect two devices and one to the motherboard. And then also SATA. So this is the recent interface that is still in use. You had one device per interface, and usually the motherboards are with like 4 to 8 different interfaces, SATA interfaces that you can use for RAID or for just single hard drives and so on. So the disks, this is about the spinning disk basically, not SSD. So this is how it works with spinning disk. You have the different platters, they're metallic platters, stick together they usually. You have the special like servo that spins these platters. There can be more than one. Then you have the heads that are just placed in between the platters. So you have like two heads, for example, for one platter. Like in this example, have 8 heads and 4 platters. And then the internal like physical structure of the disk, it's just separated into the cylinders and sectors. So basically on this picture you can see that they have also a track and then cylinder, which just basically all tracks around the cylinder. And then the fixed amount of sectors per each of the cylinder. So usually they have 63 sectors. The older disks. So the older disk, they also call the constant angular velocity, meaning that independent from the position of the head, we will have the same speed of the sectors. So they will be rotating at the same speed. And then when, for example, the data is placed on the hard drive, they usually have three parameters. It's what cylinder, what head, and what sector. So where is the data is located on the hard drive. But the those are basically old layouts. So this was done like before, and it's changing now. So now basically what the producer changed, they use the so-called zone bit recording. So you have the different amount of sectors on inner cylinders and outer cylinders. So basically before there was constant amount of sectors with different so basically the density of data was bigger here and the density of data was smaller on the outer cylinders. While currently they just put like different zones. So for example, on this picture you have three zones and the number of sectors changing. So the inner zone will have one amount of sectors, then it will be increasing over and over like to the outer one. So they kind of try to preserve the density of the data on the platter, but changing the number of sectors. So it's like, for example, three zones here. And also, there was change in standards. So before there was 512 bytes per sector, so in each sector, in cylinder. But now they're changing to 4K to have more data on the disks. So basically, another problem that the file system was starting from 63, because the first cylinder was ending at 63, because of 63 sectors per cylinder. And then it was starting the file system, the partition. And now they're changing it so that probably some of you heard about the 1 megabyte alignment, so that the file system, they need to be aligned to get the best performance from these disks. And of course, the way how the boot record stored. So there can be the master boot record, which was quite popular before, but due to limitations and due to other restriction, it's getting replaced with the GPT, which is a newer version. Like you can have a lot of things with GPT. So because like before, for example, with the MBR, you can have like four partitions, and then you can have, for example, the extended partitions and so on. So just like there are lots of limitations in the number of partitions, the size, and so on. And then the, for example, the logical structure of the disks, they also differs. So you have the disks, the physical disks, and then you have the logical structure, how the data are placed. So basically, the first thing that come after the boot record will be the partition. So you can have, like, for example, here is just example of the partition. And then inside the partition, you'll have the operating system volume. So it can be, for example, Windows, it can be Linux, and so on. The difference is that you have this backup boot record, which for the volume is not stored. So the volume is not aware about these things. So it's only for partition. And of course, there can be different modifications. Like, for example, for RAID, you can have multiple partitions combined together. So it's really nice because, like, you can have one big partition and couple of the smaller disks that assemble this partition. So the MBR started in 1983 with IBM. So there were a lot of changes, a lot of like new additions of this system. But due to limitation, logically, there was a new standard. I think it was proposed by Intel not that long time ago. It's called GPT. So basically, the global identifier about the global identifier, which is used in the partition name, is 128-bit long string, and this is unique, so you can have just enormous amount of partitions there. So the MBR is, you can have 512 megabytes bytes of data first, so which is called also absolute sector zero. So the start of the disk, and then you have the boot code, the disk signature, then the partition definition, then the volume definition, and so on. So it's a lot of structures together, and for each structure you need some kind of like abstraction level. So you need to understand what's the functionality of this structure. So why you need to have this structure in the disk. So you have the volume, you have the partition here, and you can have, for example, a couple of the partitions. So they can be primary, they can be logical, for example, and so on, and then also volume. For example, on the Windows, you can have, let's say, volume C, volume D, for example, for storing different types of files, and which are placed on the partitions, some kind of partitions that you defined before the installation of the system. This is the structure of MBR. You have the master boot record here at the top, so it comes usually first. And then you have the table, so they have like four links to the partition table. So this is partition table, and then four links. So you can have four partitions at the same time. And then the basically the boot sector of each partition, and then the data inside this partition. So to have more partition, you need to use the extended partition. So you have it here, for example. To create the extended partition from the file system point of view, it looks like one partition, but inside, logically, you create some additional partitions. For example, you need more. So you need eight, but the system can only offer you four. So you just create extended, and you can have more of those. So that's quite nice how to overcome limitation of the MBR in this case. For example, how many of you try to use the extended partition on your system? So it's not quite popular, but like you need to be aware of those, because if you destroy the link to this extended partition, then you'll just see those that are mounted, for example, these three, but not the fourth one, which is extended. And of course, you can see that like there are some space missing in overall size of the disk, which is devoted to location of this extended partition. So to overcome these limitations, the global unique identifiers were used, basically the GPT partition table. So it's 128 bits, and they use different numbers inside this identifier, like for example the time and so on. So it's, you can check the specification how the identifier is constructed. And also it uses the 64-bit LBA, logical block addressing, for storing the sector numbers. So obviously you can have much larger disks in this case. Have any questions, maybe? All right. So those systems are still in use, like MBR and GPT. You can still find like on older computers, for example, that they're still using, but it's slowly moving towards the GPT at some point. And then like the one of the major limitations of MBR was that the size of the of the partition was no bigger than 2 terabytes, so it was quite a problem recently, because you can have like disk with 4 terabytes of data and so on. So it can be a problem now, because before, when it was developed in 1983, there were like disk with megabytes, 100 megabytes, maybe 10 megabytes of data, and no more. So it was fine for that period, but now the industry came like to new standard, the GPT. So the physical structure of the disk, then you have the partitions, then you have the volume, and then you have the file system. So the file system is basically used by the by the operating system to store the files, to store some additional information, system information, and to use it like to boot from the file system. How many of you tried floppy disks? Okay. Because apparently, like for maybe, I don't know, 15 years, it's no longer in use, and it's hardly you can find computers with the floppies. Because I mean, it's much easier to use the USB stick with gigabytes, 60 gigabytes of data than just like 1.4 megabyte flash card, which can be corrupted, for example, due to some physical electric influence. So before there were a lot of different standards for the floppy drives, like 5.25, 3.5, for example, and so on. So the bigger floppies, then the smaller one, and so on. So the maximum size of the 3.5 was 1.4. There were some tricks how to increase it, how to compress data, for example, but the normal size one was 1.4. There were also different file systems for those, the FAT, different like 12, 16, and 34, for example. It depends on the year when the floppy was produced and the operating system that was in use at that time, so you can find this system still in use. And of course, the limitation of the system, like for example, the FAT32 was 4 gigabytes. So for example, just as case, if you try to use a USB stick that had FAT32, and you try to copy, for example, ISO file with 5-6 gigabytes, then at some point you'll get an error saying that you cannot copy this file. So to overcome this limitation, there was proposed the XFAT that is quite popular for the USB sticks or memory sticks to store the information, that has much bigger file size limits and so on. So you still can find a lot of the memory sticks, for example, that use XFAT. Then the Microsoft NTFS came. So there was in 1993 with NT. So that's still in use on the Windows machines, and it has a lot of new features in comparison to FAT. So not just the overcome limitations of the number of files, of the size of the files, for example, but also, for example, the file name. Because the problem with FAT was that you can have only 8 symbols in the file name plus 3 symbols in extension. So it was a problem when, for example, if you launch the MS-DOS and you try to look through the files that are created in the new system, you'll have things like this. So 8 symbols plus 3 symbols. So just got replaced. So it was a problem, like, because you cannot have, if you need to have more files, it's not a big amount that you can like fit into the 8 symbols. So that was a case why they moved to a new system called NTFS in 1993. There was also links, support of links, and there was support of alternate data streams. Who knows what is ADS? So basically, the thing is that if you have file in Windows, there can be so-called alternate data streams, not just one, but like, for example, multiple. And it's kind of like linked to the main file. So you can, for example, have those files in different zones, for example, security zones, because the advantage of the NTFS also that you have also different attributes related to security, like access control and so on. So, and I think, for example, that you can create several. It's a kind of link to the primary file, but the problem that a lot of malware developers were using these files, because you can create some kind of zone identifier for some benign file, like, for example, the calc.exe, which links to a malware, and when the calculator is launched, have a malware launched, and so on. So also it was a problem. Plus the antivirus vendors didn't scan through these alternate data streams at some point. So there were some security considerations. If we talk about Linux, there were also some evolution of the systems, like for the Linux, there were like EXT file systems, like 2, 3, and 4. They were supporting the journaling, the table-based directory, for example, structures, and so on. There was XFS from also 1993, so B3-based directory structure. You have just the links to the directory. And then GFS for IBM Linux, Unix. The one from Oracle called BTRFS. And also the ZFS, which is quite popular because it was designed for large computational systems like big servers, for example. It supports healing, it supports balancing, and so on. So it's really nice system. For example, the FreeBSD is implemented it right now, so you can use this system and get advantage. It's a lot of nice features for the high load servers. So it's quite easy to scale it up. And so on. So just like the personal computer servers, but you also have the mobile devices, for example, Android, the macOS, for example, and so on. So it's a lot of things. So how the data are stored in the file system? You have for Windows, for example, so-called clusters. So basically, the data are stored in clusters, and then multiple clusters, they form the file, for example. So the logical file, which also includes some attributes of the file, whether it's hidden, for example, or not, the name of the file, the password this file is stored, the mark times, the modification access and creation time, and so on. So it's a lot of things that need to take into consideration when you look into files on the file system. So there can be one unit which is called cluster. It's on Windows, or one, for example, block on Unix machines, on Linux. So this can be, for example, one cluster or one block equal to one sector on the hard drive. So the logical one just equal to a physical one, or they can be just multiple, depending on how you adjust the settings of the system. And also, for example, if we talk about the clusters, so how the data is stored, if you have, for example, let's say 4 kilobytes data, 4 kilobytes cluster, then everything is stored in the cluster, so you don't have any free space. But if you have the, for example, the part of the file which is smaller than the whole cluster, then there will be some data that was there before, but it wasn't overwritten, for example. So this is called the slack space. You can recover a lot of things from the slack space, and it's often used for forensics investigation because you can analyze those, and also you can recover some like interesting artifacts from this slack space. And the same stands for the RAM. So you can have also different things in RAM. You can analyze this data, you can extract. I mean, only in case if the computer is running. Right? I guess we can have a break for like 10 minutes. I can, yeah.
Okay, but you are not reading.
No.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll keep it. You mentioned the Jeeples earlier in your presentation.
Yep, yep.
Do you have any association with Jeeples?
Yeah. I guess we can start. So we talked about the slug space, basically the part of the cluster that you can find some information, so it's quite important. And I think during the exercises you will see some examples how to do is an allocated space or the slug space. So the NTFS mostly used on the desktop computer, so I guess many of you have Windows, and then on the Windows machines you usually have NTFS. For servers it's quite different because like there were quite big popularity of Windows Server like 2008, something like this. But now the Linux is taking over. It's a lot of prerequisites for this, but apparently the NTFS is still takes a lot of big market share on laptops and on desktop computers. There were different versions of the NTFS, so like 1.x, 3.x, for example, that is currently in use and so on. And in comparison to FAT, for example, then I think about the NTFS that it supports a lot of attributes for the file. For example, you can define the access control mechanism, quotas, and so on. So it's a lot of things that basically as in NTFS. And a lot of different things like, for example, encryption, the parse point, where you just can duplicate the parameters of the system. You have the BitLocker, which is present in the Windows, I think after Vista, if I'm not mistaken. So they have the BitLocker, the data on the disk can be encrypted. Journaling, basically to store what's happening on the file system, in order to be able to recover at some point. So there is a journal that just stores all of the modification of the files on the system. Also compression, sparse files. Sparse files, basically the file that you have, large file, but some of the places, they're just empty, so it's nothing there. The metadata, so it's a lot of metadata is NTFS. It's a lot of different parameters. Yep.
I have a question.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure because I think there was a solution from Microsoft that you can retrieve a key, if I'm not mistaken. There was an article that basically points to some of the Microsoft platform that you can get like kind of key for restoring access. So I'm not sure if this works in this case, but might be a solution. So I'm not quite sure, honestly. But as far as I know, that Microsoft provides basically this recovery key. Mm-hmm. There might be some workarounds how to get the key, how to restore it. Because it's software vendors, basically. In this case, it's Microsoft. It's not like, for example, you have the Intel SGX now, which provides like enclaves, basically like secure execution of the software, secure like store of the data, where the basically there should be established collaboration between the Intel and the software developers, so they have to be trusted, kind of. So in this case, it's just Microsoft, so I think it might be possible. So I don't have more details, but I think there should be some ways how to deal with it. Yep. So basically, there are a lot of files, so special like metadata files on NTFS. They store a lot of information about the files. For example, like master file table, where you have all the details regarding the file in the file system. and so on. So basically, you can find a lot of different structures in NTFS that stores how to find them and where these files are stored, and so on, about the partition tables, for example. So, like, for example, the data, you can have more than one the stream, the alternate data stream, meaning that, for example, your file can be in some, your user shares something, for example, directory, but the data stream can be in system 32 or system folder. So this is the data streams. And then also the information about the files, like the MAC times, so the modification, access, and creation times, and so on. And also, it's not possible to access this basically from user space. So you need some special tools to be able to access this MFT. So it's not like a special deal or something. And like, for example, I mean, probably all of you know what is defragmentation. So you have the fragmentation on NTFS, and in order to speed up the system, you need to perform the defragmentation. And then when you launch some software, I don't remember the name, like O and O defrag, for example, then you can see, for example, that some of the areas on the hard drive map, they're gray, so they're not accessible. This is, for example, MFT, the log, and so on. So basically, this is really a nice way how you can see, just launch this defragmentation tool, and you can see that those are the restricted areas with system information. So everything is collected into the MFT, so you can have a lot of things that can be retrieved, but you need special tools to read through this configuration files. Also, I think about the files in the NTFS that you can put virtually whatever you like into the attributes, and that's why it allows like development of the new versions of the additional attributes through the system, because it's open, and then you can like add your own attributes. So you can here you can have like 1 kilobyte or 1,000 byte different chunks of data affiliated with file. This is how it works. You have some base record of the file. So in this case, it's file1.txt, and you have the data attribute, and you have some data here. So what happens, for example, if you need more, so for example, if it's more than 1 kilobyte, then the links are created. So basically, you have this mapping pair, and then you point just to another chunk of data where you need to store this data, which is excessive, which is more than 1 kilobyte. 1 kilobyte, yeah. So yeah, this is basically like attribute list. You just do the mapping, and then you have the data describing this list entry. Right. So basically, think about forensics analysis related to hard drive, that you need to do sometimes the carving. So how many of you know what is file carving? So this is the process when you try to understand, when you try to extract files from the bunch of data, for example, that you know that this is picture, you know that this is text file, you know this is Microsoft Office documents, and so on. So it's quite important also to look for files if you have just bunch of data or bunch of like clusters on the file on the disks, then you look for some strings or for some artifacts. There are a lot of things also in relation to the files in NTFS that, for example, you can have one logical file but it's scattered across the disk in different clusters. That's why you have the fragmentation into NTFS. So that's a problem, because if the system is clean, then you have all the clusters, they just like aligned into one sequence. But if the system is used for a long time, there are no optimization, then you have just clusters that belong to one file scattered across like different regions on the disk, And it means that it will take more time to find this this part of file. So any questions? Also, there are a lot of attributes, as I mentioned before, that you can basically associate with file on the system. For example, you can have like the directory where the file is stored, and then you have the file name. So the file name is required for NTFS, but for Linux it is not required. So sometimes you have just an inode without any name. So it also can happen. And also the timestamps are little bit different for Linux and for example for Windows, and so on. And also, for example, on Linux, when you mount a partition, you can disable like access time. You can just like write the mount and then no A time, so no access time, and then you disable to speed up the operations. So somebody use it, and it's a bit of a problem for forensics investigation afterwards if those flags are present on the mount options. So it can be such things. So you just need to be aware when you do the processing of the data. And also about the streams, of this is the example. You have like one Word document, which is basically this is the main stream. So this is the main data, which is visible to everybody. But then from the other side, you can have like parallel streams. So this is basically the stream one is the identifier, so like different streams. And then those can be visible, for example, only to one NTFS system or NTFS volume that that operate with these files. And for example, have you tried to look into the Linux volume from Windows? Have you tried to mount this Linux, for example, ext4 on Windows? Any of you? So, for example, you have some USB stick with ext4, which is Linux system. You plug it into the Windows computer. What happens? So nothing happens because you cannot read like the Linux partition from Windows. This is the problem. So you can access FAT, you can access NTFS from Linux. So, for example, if you have Ubuntu, you can, and you have dual boot with your Windows, you can open, for example, partition, no problems. You can see all the files, all the Windows files. But for Windows, it's not compatible, so you cannot see. It will be just shown as some kind of partition, like unmapped partition, so you cannot just look inside the partition. And this is a problem, so you need to be aware that in most cases, it's Linux. From Linux, you can access a lot of other partitions. Like, for example, you can also try to mount, for example, Mac partition, HFS Plus, on Linux, so I think it's possible, so you can still access some of the data there. But for Windows it's a problem, so you cannot access any Linux file from Windows, so just keep this in mind. So this is how it's usually done with streams. You have the link, basically this is the malicious file, the computer virus. For example, you need to log all of the details that user is doing on his computer. And then you just create kind of a link or projection of this malicious file into the System32 folder, and you create basically the stream of the calculator. And when the user launches the calculator, obviously you have this file launched, the mel.exe. So the problem also with this approach that the antivirus cannot basically quarantine or cannot shut down this because it's like 32, it's a system applications that are run from this folder. And also, like after Windows Vista, this cannot be done with portable executable files. So portable executable, this is the common format of files in Windows. It's called PE. It's usually 32-bit files. So it can be executable, it can be dynamically linked libraries, and so on. And just how many of you still use Windows XP in some way or another? Okay, two. Okay, not bad. Because I mean, still somebody have these systems installed, and what's interesting, like there is just a market share. So desktop operating system in April 2017, and you can see that Windows XP is still there. And the support for Windows XP was suspended in 2014, if I'm not mistaken, and a lot of users, they were forced to come to Windows 7 or after this Windows 8, 10, and so on. And for example, if you recall the WannaCry, so everybody knows WannaCry. So there was a ransomware infection, they just encrypted the files on the system, and it was requiring some kind of payment in Bitcoin. For example, you sent like half Bitcoin, and then you got this decryption key in return. And what's interesting that a lot of computers were infected with Windows 7 because like everybody moved to this Windows 7, and then of course the share of Windows XP becomes smaller, and this like virus was targeting mostly the newer versions of the system, and also the PETA, the new ransomware that was in May, June, I think. It was also targeted in majority, like 90-something percent Windows 7 operating systems. And the Linux market share is still small. It's because like Windows, I mean, it's more designed for general users, so it's a bit easier to use. You don't need any specific technical expertise, so it's a little bit easier to use it. So you have any details about the NTFS system? So there were a couple file system for Linux, the ext2, 3, and 4. So the 4 is the latest one that basically installed of the most of the desktop computers on the servers, and so on. And then you can see it's only like 2%. So it's really a small market share for Linux. So how many of you know what is the version of ext on your Linux? Like 4? 3? Okay. So those systems like 3, for example, and 4 are still in use. There are a lot of new features in comparison to NTFS. So like file burn time, for example, the better granularity of the time. You can have like the much smaller time stamps, for example, and so on. And also the difference is not that significant here. You have the only directories, then you have the way how the like master file table or inodes and data bitmaps are stored. So this is the way how the basically the file logical file structure and the physical data blocks are mapped together. And then you have the clusters in Windows, and you have the blocks in Linux. And for example, well, probably many of you have tried to format partition in Windows, and then you can select what is the cluster size. So independently from the sector size, you can say, I mean, there are some dependencies small, but anyway, for example, if you have like 512 bytes of sector size, you can select any of those, like from 1 kilobyte or from 512 byte up to 64 kilobytes cluster size. So why it is done? For example, you have a big files with gigabytes, so the partition has only big files. And then in this case, it makes sense to have a bigger clusters so that the files are not that scattered across the disk. So in this case, well, normally it's 4 kilobytes, I think. And then also for sector size 4 kilobytes, which is advanced standard now, they use of course like at least 4 kilobytes or bigger. And also the LBA, logical block addressing. So how this done, or cylinder, head, and sector in this case, because of clusters. There were a lot of things that you need to know about the ext file system, which is like basically block bitmap. So it represents location in bit location of the state of each block, and then it's also inode. So you have the map of inodes, so the state of each inode on the system. So there is a limited amount of anodes usually in the system. You can check this by running some commands in Linux. And then you have the anode table, and you have basically the data blocks. So this is where the data of the file can be collected. Then you have the block groups. So basically you can have multiple block groups, and those are also correspond to a particular like set of the descriptors of the data block bitmap, and so on. So this is also kind of a tree structure. The inodes, this is the structure which describes files on Linux. There are a lot of different substructures that are included into this block. It can be referenced to direct blocks, up to like 12 pointers. Then it can be referenced to indirect blocks. Then it can be also referenced to double indirect blocks, so just another indirect block and then another one to have bigger file size, for example. The permission, information about the permission to this file, because you can have, as you know, the bitmap of the permission, like it's a mask usually that defines permission of the user, of the group, and other users. So whether it can be executed, whether it can be read or write. And then owner information and the timestamps. And the difference that they can be also the inodes without the file names. So it's not necessarily that the files in Linux have like file names. So this is the biggest difference between the NTFS and the EXT file systems. And also there can be other cases, like there can be many different names. So some of you probably know what is hard link and soft link in Linux. Just raise your hand who knows. Okay. So basically soft link is just like the link from one file to another one, while hard link is the link from the file to inode. So again, there can be multiple hard links from several files to this inode. So it's just a different way how this represented in Linux. And of course the normal example when you have just one file name for the file. So it's a lot of things. For example, in case of NTFS, when you delete the file, for example, you place the file into the recycle bin, you press delete, the file is not deleted. So it's still there, and it will be there until something is overwriting this file, so some new files or something else. So it's still there, you can retrieve this file, it's no problem. So this is advantage in terms of forensics for NTFS, that you can retrieve any deleted files if it's not overwritten. For EXT it's a little bit different. So when the file is deleted, in the table the first character of the file name is replaced with just like question mark. So for example, when you try to carve the files, you will find a lot of files with like question marks. So basically it means that they just mark as they deleted, but in fact they're there and you can retrieve them. So there is a tool for Linux called Test Disk. It's a really nice tool because you can restore the partition table, you can restore the volumes, you can restore any kind of deleted files from Linux. So it's really nice. You just like note it down because you might need it if you accidentally delete something, then just use this tool. So we talked about the physical disk layout, how it's done on the hardware level. Then we talked about the file system structure, and we also talked about the operating system levels, how this information is stored on the disks and how it's retrieved and deleted. Yeah, registry. It's a nice source of artifact because basically all the configuration of Windows and also user configuration is stored in the registry. So you can also access yourself this database, and then you can check some options for the programs, some options for the system in overall, and so on. So this is really nice, and in most cases it makes sense to look inside the registry of Windows registry to retrieve some relevant forensics information. So like, for example, what programs can run on startup and so on. So this is related to the disk artifacts. So for example, you can retrieve the files from the disk, and you can also retrieve some kind of configuration settings from the registry. And recycle bin, yeah, because in case if you delete something, it's still there, so if you need to make sure that your files are not there, you need to use some kind of tools that erase the free space. So there are a lot of different standards. The simple one is it replaces everything with zeros, or it can replace with some random numbers and can perform several stages of erasing, for example, and so on. So it's a lot of things how you can get rid of those deleted files. Then it's also event logs, because in Windows there are a lot of things that are stored in event logs. So something happening, then you can see like the system started, then the user started this program, and so on. So it's really nice thing to access. Yeah, and also page file, because you have the virtual memory for Windows. For example, for older computers with not that much memory, like 512 megabytes, 1 gigabyte, it was quite popular to use a page file. For example, you have some program running, it gets out of like memory, it gets like 1.5 gigabyte, then it just stores all unnecessary at this moment pages, they just dump into the page file. And it's disabled on SSD, because the problem with SSD, it's that it gets degraded over time. So you don't need to have this kind of page file on SSD, because then you'll just damage it. Plus the size of RAM on modern computers is quite big. And do you know this file? Why we need this file? No hibernation? Okay. So basically you have two ways how you deal with your computer if you need to move it, or like laptop to other place. When you close, they can be suspended. So basically the system is still running. So you can hear that the fan is still there. It's running basically, but it just disables everything that is not required. So just like, it's kind of sleep mode. And then you have a hibernation mode, which is kind of a deep sleep mode. So it disables everything. It dumps all the memory to the file called hyperfile.sys, and then disables. So basically it just maintains kind of the power is still there, but then the duration that you can have computer in hibernation is much longer, because the fan is not running, nothing is running. So it can be also a source of forensics evidences there. And also the running processes, so you can have a lot of different information from the running processes. Like for Windows, you can check like what are the users that run this process, what amount of, for example, memory that it takes, and so on. And also for Linux, it's quite easy to get the set of files that are opened by this process. So it's quite easy. Any questions? Right. So the problem like with operating system that you need to understand what are the timestamps, what is there, so what was done on the computer, for example, for defined time period, and sometimes you also have different time zones. So the computer was running in one time zone, then it was accessing another computer in different time zone, and of course you need to cross correlate these things. So it can be a little bit hard, plus you can have some mistakes in the configuration resulting in different timestamps. So it's hard, but because of timestamps you can make a nice picture of what's happening on the computer, and also to understand what was the cause of these actions, for example. So there are lots of ways how the attacker can use things on your computer. For example, yep. Yeah, exactly. So this is one really nice example of how things can be done. So in this case, you need to establish some kind of ground truth. So you need to understand if there is a bias, for example, what was the time stamp there, for example. And so you need to look, for example, on the computer. If it's running, then you check, like, what's the time there now. So apparently you can see that something is different. If you have computer shut down, you can check, for example, the bias, what's there, what's at the time, and so on. So basically, you need to find some piece of information that says that indeed this is the time, this is the real time that was used at that time. It can be hard because, like, if the computer is shut down, then no way you can say that this is what was like the time, like 10 days ago, for example, and so on. What you can do, for example, you can look in some system updates. So if the system updates are coming, they usually have the version number, they have the timestamp that this update was issued. For example, for Linux, it's quite easy to track. You have the server, you have the version number, and so on. So then you go to the version, you see the timestamp that it was issued, and then you can kind of cross-correlate. So probably the update came to the computer after this date, after this update was published. And it means that, well, it looks good apparently to some extent. So there is no like unique solution, so you cannot say that this is absolute trust. So you need to establish this baseline to understand whether it's truth or not. So it can be hard, but it's feasible. So during the exercises with Jeff Hamm, I think you will have some hands-on on logs and on timestamps, how to adjust these timestamps, how to change the time zone. For example, you have the Central Pacific time, for example, and the GMT, for example, UTC, and how you adjust this. So it's also important. So yeah, there can be used a lot of ways how the attacker infiltrates to your computer. This can be some malicious files. This can be some kind of useful software. So for example, you're browsing the website and there is some advertising saying that, well, this software will help you for free to clean your PC and to speed up. And for example, indeed, you have a problem with your computer, it's slow and it has a lot of junk files, for example, and you don't know how to clean it. So you download this software, then your computer gets infected and so on. So it can do anything, virtually anything on your computer. So like, for example, WinRAR or WinZip, for example, and so on. The Linux file system, it's different from Windows. There are a lot of different ways how to store the information, how to store the config files, logs, and so on. But there is a commonly accepted standard that is used across most of the system. Not everybody uses it because you know probably that there are a lot of forks like FreeBSD, Unix, Linux, and so on. So they kind of try to preserve this layout of the file system. So you have etcsim, basically the directory that, or the registry, the Linux registry that uses a lot of files to store, like passwords, for example, to store all configuration files, all the settings, and so on. So basically everything is located there. So in case of Linux, it's a little bit easier to go through the file system because everything is logically placed in the system. Then you have the next one, which is related to everything that is running currently in the system. So you can have information about the processes. You have the process ID, PID, process identifier, and then you can have a lot of information about the open file, for example, about the resources, and so on. So this is really nice in case of Linux that you can go just through directory. In case of Windows, it's a little bit more complicated because you need to know the location of these files, like Windows registry, for example, the event logs, and so on. So it takes a little bit more time. Then it's also the log files. So everything that was done on the computer is placed here, this directory, whether it's like web services, whether it's login, whether it's SSH connections, for example, and so on. So just you can get a lot of things from here. But sometimes they have some formats that you need tools to process. So it's not just like text files where you have the timestamp, the action, the user, for example, and so on. It's more like I think for logins you have some kind of own standard. So you needed some Python tool to process these files. So you can get a lot of information from who logged in, when, and from which IP, for example, and so on. So as I said, that the timeline is quite important, so you need to understand what happened in the system. And for example, if somebody was detained by police and saying that this was malware, so it's not me, and you need to prove that this was actually malware, so the malware was in the system, and those files were created by malware, and so on. It's a little bit more difficult when you have computers shut down, so you don't have access to the content of RAM, and, well, some of the malware, they can run just in RAM without any traces on the disk, and then it will be more difficult to say that this was malware. Any questions? So then the analysis by timestamp, basically you need to create some kind of table and you need to elaborate what happened on each particular like date or moment of time, for example. So for example, there can be registry modification, there can be file creation or process creation, and what exactly happened and some other information. So you need to keep track of those things. For example, there is a nice tool called CaptureBat, where if you run this tool on Windows and then you run some other files and then you shut down this tool, the CaptureBat, then you can see what happened exactly, because it creates a log file of everything. So for example, some processes terminated, some specific registry key were modified in the Windows registry, and so on, so, and also plus the network traffic. So it's really nice tool. It's called CaptureBat. So it produces similar sheet of the logs. And also file hashing. So I guess all of you know what is hash sum. The most popular is MD5. And when you need to compare some content, like for example of the files or the hard drive images, for example, you just use this hash sum. So you say that indeed this was the hash sum of the drive, this is the hash sum of the copy of the drive. So they're identical, so nothing was changed, and this is the evidence that was recovered from the crime scene, for example. So it's not only done in case of like malware that use this hash sum, like MD5, for example, or SHA-1, for example. It's also done for filtering files. For example, you have a Windows with like hundreds, thousands of files, and you need to understand which of those actually malicious. It will take a lot of time if you go through all of the files. So what you can do, you can use the list of known to be good files. So the files that are benign according to the hash sum. And many of the antivirus vendors use this as a ground truth. For example, we have thousands of files. We eliminate 90% by using these known to be good lists, or the white list, for example. And then everything else can be checked. So it takes much smaller amount of time than just going through all of the files. So the file carving, I think you will be practicing the file carving with Jeff. The point is to discover the files even though they were deleted, for example, or the header of the file is missing. So as you know, there is a header of the file and the footer. So the header contains some information like magic number, for example, that this is the image file and this is the format, some additional attributes of the file, and so on. So if this information is deleted, it's still possible to make some kind of sense out of the bunch of raw data. So based on the statistical analysis, for example, or on some patterns, you can say that this is probably image compression, or this is encryption, or this is text because you can read the text there, and so on. So it's quite easy to get some meaning of the file, even though the information was deleted about this file. And also, it's not just file, but a lot of ways how the information is stored. It can be log files, it can be databases. So, for example, MySQL or other ways how the information is stored. And sometimes you need to go through big amounts of files or through big amount of data in one file. So it can be different. So it's good that you just make some analysis: what kind of files, what kind of information, beforehand, and then you perform this analysis. So yeah, like for example, you have the files which store the mailboxes, emails, basically information about emails. And as in case with Enron dataset, you can have a lot of emails. So you need to look for what's there. It can be attachments, it can be just a plain text, and so on. So that's why nobody uses the complete forensics. Sometimes it's more about filtering and examination of the evidences. So you need to understand what's there and what piece of that big data you need to use, and not just look for everything. Right, so this was the information about the computer forensics, the part about the disks. So I guess some new things about the disks, about the file system, about the partitioning and so on, and how it can be used. And you can try it yourself. You can use a lot of tools. It's a little bit easier on Linux because you can access this low-level information by yourself. You can check what kind of partitions you have. You can check what kind of volumes. What are the log files? What are the system files on your system, and so on. So this is really important part of the forensics investigation, to understand what's in the data, because based on data you make some conclusion about the incident or about some attacks, for example, and so on. So and all of these major criminal cases related to malware or related to the websites like dark web, for example, or the Silk Road, it was based on the evidences found on the disk or in the RAM, as for example Silk Road. So it's quite important to look into data. Right, I guess that's all. Thank you for information, for your attention. You have any questions? Yep. Once again, please. Well, you can copy if you just need the data, so if you don't need to preserve everything. But the point of this investigation, like for example criminal investigation, that you need to have everything that was on the hard drive at the moment when it was taking off. So at this point you need to use so-called read-only, so write blocker, so nothing was written on the disk if it is a physical device, so you just copy one disk to another. Or you can simply attach this hard drive to your machine and mount this hard drive in read-only mode, so nothing was changed. So at this point, if you make, for example, if you use a tool called DD, so you make a basically bit copy of the hard drive, then you can also preserve what was in the slack space. So it's not always the case, but you also can preserve what was deleted in the files. So this is sometimes what is important, to see what was deleted, because sometimes people delete the files and they thought that okay, it's not in the recycle bin, so everything is good, but then you make a bit wise copy of the hard drive and you can see that, well, this was there. And also you basically create a file like a DD file, for example, from the hard drive, and you can send it to some other company like in different part of the world, so you don't need to send a physical hard drive. You just send a copy, bit copy of the hard drive. Same as? Yeah, in a way that they basically record everything that was from the sensors, and Yeah, they kind of sealed, you know. So if you break it, then you kind of like tamper with things. So in this case, you just like seal the container with DD, for example, the bit copy, and then you have the MD5 hash sum, for example. So it means that you have the sealed container, you have the proof that it was the original one. So it's similar analogy. Right, any other questions? Yeah, because this is basically Carl's presentation. He's not here today, but he's teaching this course, and I think he will put this presentation like slides on the Blackboard. Yeah. Any other questions? Which one? The question mark, I think it was in Linux. So it goes basically, yeah, it was in NTFS. It goes to the tables, it marks, for example, this part as free, but then it replaces the file with a question mark. So basically, it's not accessible to user, but it's still there, except the fact that file name is changed. I think if you just simply delete it like through like recycle bin, then it still will be available. But for secure deletion, you need like special tools. Well, you don't like unlink this file. In this case, you just replace the file name, so you change the attribute of the file. So you don't like unlink it from the file table name, basically, and it's still there. So it's just like it feels similar, but like the process is different. So the routine how it's done is a little bit different. Any other questions? Okay, thank you for your attention. I guess we're done for today. Just don't forget to capture the flag, 6:15, and free pizza.